Judiciary is called to order. It is 1:45 and the date is April the 14th. My apologies to folks online and here in the room. Session went over today and we had our photo, so we're just a little bit late starting. Present for the record are Representatives Guerra, Holm, Samuels, Ogg, Anderson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And we have six items on the agenda today, and I'm going to take them in this order. First, House Bill 336, briefly, by Representative Myers, civil damages for uninsured drivers. Next, we're going to go to Senate Bill 344, trust estates, property transfers by Senator Seekins. And then we will go to House Bill 275, veterinarians and animals. Then we're going to go to House Bill 427, Protections of Persons and Property by Representative Anderson. Then we're going to go to House Bill 381, Child Endangerment from Driving Offenses by myself, Representative McGuire. And then finally, House Bill 546, Pollution, Discharge, and Waste Treatment Disposal. And we're going to go just a little over today if we can to try to make up for our lost time. But with that, let's get going with House Bill 336. And Ms. Cunningham is here, place of Representative Meyer. Okay, I would appreciate a motion. Representative Samuels.
Rescission motion.
No, I have to move to
That's
rescind
right.
my vote.
Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to rescind my vote on House Bill 336.
Object.
There's an objection noted to that. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on the rescission motion, which did not allow House Bill 336 to advance from this committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
And I know we debated this bill when I was here when we voted it down, but I think I'd like on the record just a reason for why we're moving to rescind it.
Representative Holm, you can choose to give a reason or choose not to. It's up to you.
Madam Chair, I don't have any reason to offer.
Okay. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Representative Ogg on the motion to rescind the committee's action in failing to move the bill.
Question, Madam Chair.
Say it again.
Question.
Representative Ogg.
I don't think I participated last time. Do I participate on this one?
Yes, you are allowed to participate.
Yes, I said.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not here. Representative Samuels?
Yes.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Five yes, one no.
Okay, and so the motion has carried to rescind our action, so I need a new motion. Representative Samuels.
I move the CS for HB 336.
Is there an objection? There's an objection noted. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on the motion to allow House Bill 336 to advance out of this committee?
Representative Ogg?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not here. Representative Samuels?
Yes.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Five yes, one no.
And so House Bill 336 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes has advanced out of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, that brings us next to Senate Bill 344. Mr. Judiciary Chairman, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Ralph Seekins from Senate District D.
Great name it is.
And anybody named Ralph is all right with me.
Oh, good.
I agree.
We agree, too.
I'm very pleased to be appearing before this august body over here, and as usual, I'm jealous of your digs
to have your own
committee room like this. The what we have before us today in Senate Bill 344 is a bill having to do with probate code and trusts. A real vital characteristic of highly developed economy is the ease with which the financial resources flow from one market to another. In fact, the magnet-like attraction between money and the market that offers the most advantageous terms is perhaps best demonstrated within the financial services industry itself. Over the years, the Alaska banking industry has attracted funds to our state as a result of a particular niche that we have successfully developed in an obscure corner of the industry known as trust and estate services. Much of this success can be attributed to the foresight demonstrated by this Alaska state legislature. Since 1997, the legislature has passed numerous bills, effectively making Alaska a premier jurisdiction for this financial specialty. Just last year, in Senate Bill 87, we adopted a more recent version of the Uniform Principal and Income Act. And House Bill 212 updated other portions of Alaska's trust laws last year. Now, both were signed into law last summer, and while Senate Bill 344 may not be as far-reaching as the other two bills, it accomplishes much the same purpose. It does this by making a host of small technical revisions to current statute. It updates provisions relating to virtual representation. It clarifies when a trustee can be relieved of liability. And it adds provisions which other jurisdictions have already adopted. Keeping our trust statutes current has had a direct positive impact on our state's economy. And over the years, these periodic revisions have helped bring hundreds of millions of dollars of trust assets into the state and added tens of millions of dollars to local bank deposits. Furthermore, it has increased business activity for attorneys, accountants, life insurance agents, and brokerage firms in the state of Alaska. Well, necessity, ingenuity, and routine advances in technology collaborate on a daily basis to reinvent the world of financial products and services. We as a state have successfully staked out a place in this world through our contemporary set of trust and estate laws. And Senate Bill 344 now seeks to preserve our position in what amounts to a highly fluid marketplace unrestricted by geographic boundaries. It seems reasonable to us, and this bill helps us to keep that money flowing in this direction. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have some experts that are available online to answer any technical questions regarding the bill.
Fantastic. Thank you, Senator. Are there questions at this time for Senator Seekin? Representative Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair. Senator, you made a comment a minute ago, and I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that, so I thought maybe I'd let you give me a little clarification. You said there's hundreds of millions of dollars that come into the state coffers or come into the state of Alaska, but only tens of millions into banks. Where does the difference go?
Trust companies, trust is developed, is brought in through the state of Alaska, trust funds. So some of those are retained in banks, some aren't. I can get Mr. Blotmacher. We've got three experts.
Okay.
Mr. Blotmacher can really probably explain that. Yeah, I think he's online with us and give you
he
a
is.
Better breakdown.
Well, thanks, Senator. And then the only other thing I had was, is this more... Seems to me like we have been over the years participatory in getting these legal positions so that we encourage people to invest into Alaska because of our law system. And is this mostly just trying to keep up with the Joneses, or just trying to be a little bit ahead of the head
I think
of
we're
the...
trying to keep ahead of them to the chair, Representative Holm. What we're looking at is we do have a very bright research group of lawyers, CPAs, that are constantly, and trust officers, that are constantly looking at how we can improve our trust laws to keep ahead of the market, to keep our, preserve our niche and to expand it. And they're the ones who, for an example, brought us this year these revisions that will help us keep on the cutting edge. As we move forward, we find that other states adopt the same principles that we do, and we're constantly looking for those areas and where we can continue to be the leading state. And
well,
we are one of the leading states.
I commend you for your actions, and thank you.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thanks. A couple of questions, Senator. Welcome. The first is I was shocked to hear you say that one of the reasons that we should support the bill is that it creates employment opportunities for attorneys, so I'm pretty sure you didn't say that, or we'll just strike that from the record.
Actually, Mr. Guerra, I have a son who is an attorney.
That's right.
Part of my conflict of interest.
That's right. Good point.
I think that's probably the first time anybody's actually said something like that on the record in this whole body in the last 30 years.
But. Must have been a mistake.
Madam Chair, maybe I should have said legitimate attorney.
So the economic part of the bill, you know, you have me sold on, right? It's it promotes the industry in the state. The substantive part of the bill, I guess I'll wait to hear from other folks. But it seems complex, and I think my gut is that we'll go through the whole bill, spend some time on it, and the changes won't be anything that caused me very much concern. But should I ask you questions about the substance,
sure,
I wait?
We can defer if you want to.
Maybe I'll just wait to hear the testimony. This the general thing though is. I mean, isn't this like the third sort of trust reform bill we've heard in the last year and 2 months, rewriting the trust laws to promote the trust industry? I got to say, that just seems odd to me that we've got three bills on the same subject by the same folks.
Chair, Representative Guerra, it is the third bill that I'm aware of that we have considered. And the third that has gone through my committee on the Senate side, and has been spawned by this very bright group of people who say these are the refinements as we continue to go through this and as we consider what other states are doing and trying to take that business away from us, that serve two purposes, that clarify trust law and keep it from getting into litigation, and also developing the economic side of the question. So I think that's been, as we looked through it on consideration, we tried to balance those two needs. And I think you'll come to the same type of conclusion, maybe not exactly the same as we did, that we really are trying to do the best thing for all of the parties involved while at the same time keeping at the forefront in terms of competing for these funds that are out there.
Yeah, and just to comment, I worked for this committee as the aide the first time that a revision was made to the original 1997 Trust Act, and that was the first bill I remember. And then my first year, I had to carry the next revision that, for all intents and purposes, eliminated the rule against perpetuity. And I remember standing up on the floor saying, I was told I was never going to have to talk about the rule against perpetuity again. And it's a very complex area of the law. And Representative Guerra is just right. And we're very lucky because we've got a group of folks that spend their hard hours working on this to stay up with law review journals and current trends and the current tax code to try to figure out a way to keep us at the forefront of it. But it's my understanding, Representative Guerra, and they can explain to you through working with this group, is that it's just it's an ever-changing body of laws, and new opinions come down, and even the tax code changes. And so it's an effort to kind of stay at the forefront of it, centering on the same policy. But it is amazing. And every time Delaware, just so you know, and they can explain it better than me too, this is such a big market for them that they can meet within 30 days a notice, and they will convene a session to come in and update both this area of the law and their corporate code structure, because it's such an important part of their economy there. So we only meet every 5 months, so we can only have that opportunity to change it every couple of years. But
if I could be Madam Chair, also Representative Guerra, probably the judiciary committees on both sides are more enlightened than previous judiciary committees in the past, if I can be a little self-serving there, Madam Chair.
He's including you in that enlightened group too, Representative Guerra. So noted, Representative Guerra is enlightened. Okay.
It's called pandering.
That's right. That's right. And with that, if without further questions, we've got five folks online that practice in this area and can tell us a little bit more about some of the specifics. Thank you, Senator Seekins. Okay, first I'm going to go to Beth Chapman because I understand she's got another engagement. And then I will go to Steve Greer, then Doug Blotmacher, then Dave Schaftel, and then Peter. I don't recognize Brodigam. I hope I get that right. So Beth Chapman, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Beth Chapman, and I'm an attorney at Foster Banfield in Juneau. And I apologize for not being there in public, but I'm on the East Coast today. I want to testify briefly in support of Senate Bill 344, and I'm going to focus only on two parts of the bill and allow the other individuals to answer questions on the other parts. I'm going to focus on the virtual representation changes, which are contained in section, and I apologize, section 2 and also section 4 dealing with limitations on proceedings against trustees. The current law that we have for notice provisions in probate and trust proceedings is out of date and is not consistent with our new complex trust and particularly dynasty trust that can last now in perpetuity. Section 2 expands the doctrine of what's known as virtual representation, but really it's called substitute notice. And this doctrine will allow notice to be served on one or more persons who have the similar interest with respect to a particular issue in a trust or estate matter, so long as there is no conflict of interest. And the modifications that are contained in Section 2 really just expand and explicitly include specific types of gifts that are commonly found in trust. I believe that this change will ensure that parties have access to the courts in a very efficient manner and is more consistent with the types of trust we are now seeing in Alaska and in all other states as well. The other provision I wanted to focus on is Section 4, and that is limitations on proceedings against trustees. Currently, we do not have a statute of limitations for proceedings against trustees for breach of trust unless there's been a final account. And many times that can be a very long period of time before any claim is to be brought against a trustee. Final account is only rendered when the trust relationship is terminated. In light of the fact that we now have trust that can last in perpetuities, and if there's been no termination of the trust relationship or trustee relationship, we may find ourselves in a situation where we have costly and extremely complex litigation arising out of a claim of a breach of trust that may have happened many, many, many years prior to the time the claim is brought to the court. Under current law, there is a 6-month statute of limitations for any claim by a beneficiary against the trustee once final accounting has been rendered. This proposal expands the statute of limitations to cover claims that could be brought on any interim accounting that may be rendered, so long as the beneficiary is provided notice of the limitation period. Under the current law, there is no requirement that the beneficiary be notified of the time limitation to bring a breach of trust claim. Now, this provision would expand the 6-month limitation period to cover interim accounting, but also require the trustee to provide the beneficiary notice of the time limit. That notice provision is consistent with what we have in the probate code when we're dealing with an estate that is going through probate rather than a trust. I testify in support of Senate Bill 344 point out that, yes, it is the third bill recently that we've seen, but in the last few years, there have been major changes in trust laws, which for those of us who studied trust law in law school many years ago realized that the laws hadn't changed for decades. As those laws change, I believe Alaska needs to continue to be in the forefront of having trust laws that are modern, provide opportunities to both Alaskans and non-residents to bring their money to Alaska and help the industry. I'll be happy to answer any questions that anybody may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chapman. Are there questions for Beth? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Ms. Chapman. This is Les Guerra speaking. So the statute of limitations rule that you propose is how many years from the time somebody should have noticed they have a claim?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it is not number of years. It's 6 months, which is the current statute of limitations that we have under current law. And that has not changed in this proposal.
So, but now it would be 6 months from an interim accounting?
That is correct, provided the beneficiary is given notice of the six-month limitation.
The current statute of limitations, it's not the greater of a certain number of years from the date something bad is done or 6 months after the final accounting? It's not something like that?
No, it is not.
Okay. I guess as a matter of policy, that one concerns me a little bit because, you know, if you're dealing with financial paperwork, whether it's from a trustee or somebody else, just allay this concern for me. Why would a consumer go through in detail to read the annual report they get from a trustee any more than I read my financial statements from my brokerage company? And why wouldn't? Isn't the law currently designed to say that people will probably pay a lot more attention to the final accounting than they will to these sort of interim accountings? And I guess by changing the law, I'm worried that we're putting consumers at hazard of losing a claim against their trustee for misconduct because they didn't read their annual paperwork closely enough.
Representative Guerra, I think that the I don't think people are going to read their interim accountings any less than they're going to read a final account. And I believe the 6 months is consistent with the approach that it's used in all probate proceedings and trust proceedings. And that is that when you're dealing with this type of relationship, which is a, and if I may, it's a little bit different than a consumer and somebody in your brokerage account. This is a relationship that is based, is a fiduciary relationship. And those accountings are very detailed and are designed to provide information to a beneficiary so that they know what has happened in an interim period. And I don't believe that they're putting it at risk. And that the six-month statute of limitations is consistent with how we approach all trust proceedings, which is you don't want these to sit around and continue to potentially be brought many years later because you put the trust at risk, not just a trustee, but many times you have a beneficiary who may become disgruntled down the line, and if they can go back that many years, you're putting all the other beneficiaries at risk as well. I believe the six-month statute of limitations is protective of all the beneficiaries of a trust, and more so than I think it's protective of a trustee, because it ensures that you cannot allow a disgruntled beneficiary many years later to bring a claim, whether it's valid or brought in bad faith, and tie up trust assets, cause a trustee to defend a claim, which if the trustee has not reached their fiduciary duty, of course, is paid from the trust asset. And I believe this will ensure that those claims are brought in a timely manner.
Why don't you just want to follow up?
Representative Kira?
Yeah, Ms. Chapman, so let me ask you this. Do the claims that get barred under this new statute of limitations, would those include claims where somebody's been defrauded by a trustee? Would those also be limited?
No.
Okay.
I don't know.
Where in the bill does it limit the kind?
Bear with me while I try to find that in here.
Seems to cover claims for breach of trust, which.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it would cover all claims. The breach of any breach of trust claim.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, I assume that this would probably lower possible claims against attorneys for malpractice.
Through the chair. Representative Gruenberg, I hadn't thought of that. I don't know if it would or wouldn't. I think that...
Because if you shorten the statute of limitations, I'm looking at what's called a tail on my malpractice insurance now. It seems to me this would significantly reduce the tail for these kinds of claims.
Well, that's if an attorney is serving as a trustee representative.
That's my hypothetical.
Okay, all right. Based on that hypothetical, I yes, it would, but I have to say, I don't know how many attorneys serve as trustees of trust. Our policy, we do not. But yes, it would have that same effect.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Chapman? Okay, thanks. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you very much. I'm gonna step off the line then. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Okay, Steve Greer. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chairman.
Good.
As in the past, this has been a coordinated effort by a group of attorneys. I've read the bill in its entirety and have had some added input with respect to this bill. What I'd like to do, however, is defer to those individuals who have been most recently involved with the bill and who have, in fact, drafted the remaining provisions of the bill. That person would be Dave Chaptel. I would also like to reserve comment at a later point in time. I would like to say that Peter Brodigam will have some interesting back to the notice provisions, and I think his commentary is well worth hearing. But it's a very good bill. I will tell you also that one of the reasons that we come forward every year with a new bill is that it takes an incredible amount of time to research this bill, to research the bill, to research the law, to pass it around to other members. And all of us have our own practices. None of us are being paid. And it's just that Alaska, I think, is very fortunate in having a group of attorneys who are so interested in the area of law in which they practice that they're willing to put forth this effort. And if we can't do it all at once, then we've taken it piece by piece. And with that, I really have no nothing else to say.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Okay, with that, Dave Chaptel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Judiciary Committee. Just briefly on this, what we might call the moving target characteristic of the state trust law. We know, we started out in 1997 as really being the first state to enter this area and to come up with some new ideas in the financial area. We were immediately followed by Delaware. In 1999, Nevada and Rhode Island similarly enacted trust laws, and now this last year, in 2003, Utah has enacted a similar trust law that has taken effect now in January 1 of 2004. So now there are five states in this arena, and this is the arena dealing with spendthrift trusts, dealing with the abolishing the rule against perpetuities and providing tax and asset protection approaches for estate planners and for their clients. Both these clients, of course, and many of the attorneys who you will hear today, the vast majority of our clients are Alaskans who are taking advantage of these laws. For the trust companies and banks, they're experiencing the business from non-Alaskans, residents from other states who can choose to take advantage of our law, or they can choose to take advantage of one of the other four states' laws. A little more background for you. All of us who are testifying today participate annually in a conference in Miami, which consists of all of the major or active state planning attorneys nationwide and estate planning accountants. This last year, representatives from each of the five states participated in making a presentation, which was very well attended at that conference. There were critiques from the audience and from the participants of each state's laws and comparisons of each state's laws. A number of the provisions which you have before you today are provisions which have either been enacted in other states, such as Delaware, Utah, or Rhode Island, which we don't have yet, or provisions which were discussed at that conference and which will be enacted in those states and which we are proposing be enacted in Alaska as well. Those provisions consist of sections 3, 8, 9, 10, and 11 of the Act, and they deal with subjects such as moving trust to Alaska. To give you an example, our statute was criticized by other another state, saying that, well, we construe your statute to be very limited, and that if somebody wanted to move an existing trust to Alaska, that trust would have to have in it a reference saying that Alaska law would apply. Well, we looked at our statute and felt that it was ambiguous on that point, and saw where the criticism was coming from, so we've clarified it in this bill. Delaware and Utah have a provision that makes it clear that the spendthrift trust limitation in their statutes is intended to come within the spendthrift trust restriction under the bankruptcy code. We don't have that provision, but it is something that is being used by other states to say their law is superior. So we've included that in this bill. Delaware has a provision which says that what are called qualified personal residence trusts, which are it's a tax planning approach, minimize the taxation on your personal residence. It's your debt.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Yeah, David, this is Max Groomer. Is that a Q-tip trust?
No, a Q-tip trust is a trust that's a marital trust that's designed to defer taxation when the first spouse dies until the second spouse dies. This one, though, has a similar acronym. It's a QPERT. It's QPRT, a Qualified Personal Residence Trust. Now, they're also within that Section 9 is another acronym, a GRAT, which is a Grantor Retained Annuity Trust, which is another method for transferring often business interests in minimizing the taxation when business interests are transferred. The GRATs are expressly allowed by the Internal Revenue Code and its regulations, and we've included those in our spendthrift trust protection legislation here for you to consider today. Another provision that came up at the conference had to do with a provision that both Delaware has and we copied from Delaware that says that trustees and other persons who are participate in the formation and implementation of spendthrift trusts not be personally liable if there's a fraudulent transfer. Rather, the fraudulent transfer liability goes against the trust. The property has to be returned and goes against the settlor of the trust who commits the fraudulent transfer. We've added a provision because for tax minimization purposes, which most of the trusts in Alaska, when they're created, are created to help Alaska residents and others who are using Alaska law minimize the federal estate tax, which will occur at their death. And so to do that, when we form these types of trusts, we often, almost always, first form a limited partnership or a limited liability company, transfer the assets into that entity, and then transfer the interest in that entity into the trust. And so we've added a provision here, which came out of this national conference, which we participated in, which would provide for protection for the trustee and for other persons with regard to the formation of those entities. Delaware and Rhode Island have a provision also which says that if there is an action brought, and this is really a provision that helps us implement last year's bill, House Bill 212, if there's an action brought to challenging a transfer to a trust as a fraudulent transfer, that action needs to be brought in Alaska and in the Superior Court here and not elsewhere, and so that our courts can consider it. And so that's in Section 11 of the bill. Now, there are two sections of the bill that contain technical corrections, and Senator Steekins referred to the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which you enacted last year, which it was just an excellent addition to our trusts and estates law. There are a couple of very minor references, code references, or section references, actually, in that bill that were incorrect. And so those have been caught, and those are technical corrections that need to be enacted. There's also an additional savings clause provision relating to Representative Grunberg. You asked about marital trusts, and this is in Section 7. And it adds a sentence that says, it's a savings provision, that for marital trusts, that all the income has to be distributed annually. In case someone drafted a trust and failed to put that provision in there, it could fail QTIP status and therefore result in a major tax at the death of the first spouse. This provision, what we call it a savings clause, will save that QTIP trust and let it qualify for deferring the tax until the second spouse dies. So you'll find that in Section 7. There's one other change, and that has to do with voting trusts. We have a statute, and this you'll find in Section 1, that allows for voting trusts, but has a 10-year duration limitation on it. But then it allows voting agreements and has no time limitation. And I've had clients who've been interested in voting trusts, and I've talked with and communicated with attorneys in other states and asked them about their voting trust law, and some other states do not have any time limitation on their voting trust. There doesn't seem to be any logical reason, and that was the commentary that I received back from people who were interested. If we can have voting agreements without time limitations, we ought to be able to have voting trusts. So a voting trust is where you take the stock certificates. Let's say you have a closely held small business, and the family members decide that they want to give control to one or more family members for a period of time. And I have clients who've wanted to do this. And so you take the stock certificates and you put them into the voting trust for a period of time. And for example, I have one client who wanted to do it for 20 years. Other clients may want to do it for a longer period of time. Some may be satisfied with 10 years or less, but there doesn't seem to be any reason to limit that period, because it has to be agreed to by everyone. Everyone has to have capacity to limit their stock voting rights in this way. They can do this with a voting agreement. The voting agreement, you don't take the actual stock certificates and put them in trust. You just sign a separate agreement where you would be sued if you somehow transferred
Dave?
Or voted your...
Dave?
Yes.
I think we're good.
Okay.
We're losing members here.
That's the last comment
them.
I had, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you have. And thank you very much. I think it's an excellent bill, and urge you to support it.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The provision on the Q-tip, was that Section 8? Section 7.
Section 7.
You referred to it, Mr. Shaftel, as a savings clause. It doesn't appear to be on the face, but, you know, I'm not familiar with how these are normally drafted. It sounds like the concept you're trying to do is to keep the tax status even if somebody leaves the magic language out of the trust.
And that's absolutely right.
What I'm wondering is, since, you know, the failings of an attorney or a drafter can be infinite, as my own experience, is there any way we can do any kind of a general savings if language, and I'm saying something technical, and I don't practice, as you know, don't practice in this area at all, but something that would say, if technical language is left out, it should not be presumed that this was intentional, and that the tax status should not be affected thereby, and have a state law that would say something like, it should be presumed that all necessary tax language to get the deductions is in these instruments. Can we do something like that?
It's an interesting idea. We do put such language in our trusts, but not all attorneys. You know, in other words, we have general savings clauses that are similar to what you're talking about, where we indicate that there's the intent, for example, if we're dealing with a marital deduction trust, it's the intent to qualify for a marital deduction. and that all of the language and provisions of this trust instrument will be so construed in order to qualify under Internal Revenue Code 2056. But so you're right on. I mean, your suggestion is a good one. Now, in state law, generally what you see are these more specific types of savings provisions, such as, you know, there are two of them that you're looking at in Section 7, one of which is already our law, and that last sentence which we're adding. Let our group give some thought to your suggestion, and perhaps, you know, and this is, as everyone has discussed before, this will come back to you again, and maybe we can improve on this.
Well, does the bill go from here to the floor?
Yes.
Because, you know, it seems to me that if your group could meet in the next few days and we could catch this and even do it on the floor, I mean, that's an important thing. I don't think anybody around here wants to see Alaskans have to pay taxes on something like this when they don't have to. And we don't want to see a bunch of malpractice actions in something like this either. And if we can cure this by adding some kind of a catch-all, and you can say to the maximum extent constitutionally permissible or something like that, you know, maybe we'll save people and save them taxes and, you know, help them.
Okay, if you want to think about that, Dave, and let us know before it gets to the floor.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gunn.
You're welcome. Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Dave, this is Les Guerra speaking. I've got two sections of the bill sort of jump out at me as ones that I have some concerns with. You heard me talk about Section 4, and if you have any comments on that, we might have a back and forth. But I'm now looking at Section 11. And apart from the intended consequences of this that might be benign or favorable, I'm looking at Section 11 and starting on line 29, page 9, it seems to say that one of the things you can't do if, let's say you've been dealing with somebody who has all of their money in a trust, and it's a business relationship, and the person on the other side steals your money. I mean, does something very untoward in the business relationship and ends up owing you a lot of money. They want to come after you, but all your money is in a trust. And this seems to say that if they prevailed in their case against you, prove that you took money from them, and then tried to go after the trust to execute on the judgment, it seems to say that you can't. Am I misreading that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, no, I don't think you are. But I think you need to go back in analyzing this, that perhaps we need to go back and think about the facts that you're presenting. If this the evildoer in your scenario had transferred assets to a spendthrift trust well before the actions and fraud or other conduct was involved here, and that trust had been set up correctly and was implemented correctly, and there was an independent trustee who had absolute discretion to make distributions to that particular person or other members of his family, then the harmed party could not get at the assets in that trust. And that's true of whether we're talking about a self-settled trust or a third-party trust. If that person's parents had created a spendthrift trust, and keep in mind we're talking about an irrevocable trust that person has no control himself over anymore. There's an independent trustee, and funds had been put in this trust by his parents at a prior date. And then at a later time in his life, he went out and committed a fraud or a theft or something worse. You couldn't get at those assets in that trust. That's just the law. That's the law in every state dealing with spendthrift trusts. And it's the law in 5 states dealing with self-settled spendthrift trusts if they were created, funded, and are truly independent and implemented correctly.
So, Dave, how does subsection L then change current Alaska law in that regard?
Subsection 11 is a, I'm sorry, subsection L in section 11 is a provision that we are taking almost verbatim from Delaware and Rhode Island. What the purpose of this section is to require that if someone is challenging a transfer to a trust, let's take your scenario. And in your scenario, let's, and we're primarily dealing with, this will come up with non-residents. A non-resident in New York argues that the person who set up this Alaska Trust committed a fraudulent transfer. And to give you an example of a fraudulent transfer, let's take your scenario, but put it in New York State, and say that this person, after or in the, while he was in the process of defrauding the victim, also transferred assets to a trust in Alaska. That's a fraudulent transfer, and it should be set aside. And what this provision here says, though, is that the action to set it aside has to occur in Alaska and not in New York. And what's important about that is it has Alaska's procedural law applied, and Alaska's statute of limitations applies to it. And Alaska court gets to judge the validity of this Alaska trust, which is set up under Alaska law. This is, as I say, forgive me for repeating myself, but this is a provision that's been enacted in both Delaware and in Rhode Island, but for exactly the purpose that I've described.
Yeah, the jurisdictional part I don't have a problem with, so I understand the part where you want Alaska law to apply, though frankly all 50 states do that, and I don't know that that really benefits the people who benefit from the trust if every state sort of requires you to go to another state to deal with an action. But that aside, I don't have a problem with that. I just want to make sure that substantively we're not giving anybody 1 ounce more ability to avoid paying for their misconduct by putting money in a trust. And I understand you can get at the trust if you can show that money is fraudulently hidden in a trust. I understand that part. Leave that aside, I want to make sure that, apart from that circumstance, I want to make sure that we're not doing anything that makes it easier for somebody to avoid their personal responsibility for something that they owe to somebody else.
That is not the intent of this provision, nor do I see that it does do what you fear.
Well, then if we're, I guess the drafting question then is, if we're, why are we adding a brand new section that includes this rule that says you can't recover from the person's trust? I mean, if that already exists in the law, why do we restate it in this new, by writing a new subsection?
When you get into the area of conflict of laws, dealing with trusts and dealing with fraudulent transfers and dealing with which state's statute of limitations, not substantive law, but which state's statute of limitations applies. If the state that, the forum state, which is Alaska, if it has a provision in its law that says that its law and its courts are going to have jurisdiction, then that procedural statute of limitations provision will be applied, even if they were to apply the substantive law of New York, in our example. So a court could decide, our Alaska court could decide to apply New York's substantive fraudulent transfer law under the basic rules of in the area of conflict of laws, but they would apply Alaska's statute of limitations law because we have this choice of law provision in our statute.
Yeah.
One last question, Madam Chair.
President Guerra?
Yeah. So, Dave, that's fine for me. I just need to see where in existing law do we have this rule that says you can't go after the trust assets if you've been victimized by the person whose trust it is. I want to be able.
You're in the code section. It's 3441.10, You just have to move back up, all the way up, and that's our spendthrift trust provision that...
So it's also located in current 344110?
Yes.
Okay.
And just started, if you go back to that code section, go to subsection A, first paragraph, gives you the general rule.
Yeah, and Dave, that was the bill that I carried, and I remember Representative Croft and I worked on that very stringently, that part, to be sure that the self-settled spendthrift trust wouldn't be used for fraudulent means.
Yes.
So there's a lot of stuff on the record on that. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. First of all, on page 10 of the bill, line 4, you state the Superior Court has jurisdiction. We have right now district court jurisdiction up to $50,000, and we have a bill that will increase it up to $100,000. I hope we'll be going to the floor the next few days. Is there a reason why it has to be Superior Court, and we can't just say courts of this state?
No, there's no reason other than, you know, it's the Court of General Trial jurisdiction, but I understand your point, and there's no reason it couldn't be the district court as well.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll make that at the appropriate time. Second question, and this is something that doesn't deal with the bill this year, but it dealt with something, maybe we did last year, Mr. Schaftel, page 9, line 13 and 14. Having seen somewhat the range of emotions in the field of family law, I know that there are virtually no rules, and people will do anything they can. And what this says, apparently, is that you normally, a creditor can't get at these trusts, and then on page 8, line 9, it says, unless the creditor is a creditor of the settlor, and at the time of transfer, the settlor's in default by 30 or more days of making a payment due under a child support order. Now, it seems to me, if we were smart lawyers representing Joe Deadbeat, who didn't want to support little innocent over here, we would simply say, bring your stuff up to date, and they can't get you, even if you're planning to do something. Maybe I'm misreading it, but you see, it focuses on at the time of the transfer.
Yes, Madam Chair, and through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, this provision has been discussed at length with regard to prior bills, and actually it goes back to the original bill in 1997. And I know that Doug Wachmacher at the Alaska Trust Company has testified at length about it. Mm-hmm. The problem with changing this provision and broadening it to cure what you're concerned with is that you basically what happens is you destroy the transfer tax minimization benefit of these trusts, and what would happen is, and I'll try, because Madam Chair, you've already admonished me for talking too much, so I'll give you the bottom line, and then if you want a long-winded explanation, I'd be happy to. But the bottom line is that if you change this provision and broaden it, then all gifts to these trusts would be incomplete gifts, and all of the trust assets would be included in the settlor's gross estate at death, and we would deprive Alaskans of the ability to save transfer taxes by using these trusts in a way that really would be a shame to do that. Now, the discussions in the past have pointed out that these trusts have not been, there's no experience, no actual experience at all with these trusts being used by deadbeat dads, right, or deadbeat moms for that matter, to defeat child support. And that the tax benefit that I just referred to greatly outweighs the hypothetical. And from a theoretical standpoint, Representative Grunberg, you know, you're absolutely correct. But it greatly outweighs our experience. And if we ever do have an experience where this becomes a major problem or a significant problem, then it should be addressed. But right now, the price is way too great.
Yeah, that's, and just to add, Representative Grunberg, that was something that was also addressed in one of the bills that I carried. And we worked with the Child Support Enforcement Division. And remember, Dave, there was one point where a proposal would have been to put it out more like 90 days or even 120. So this was a compromise that we came up with to say that very serious. I mean, 30 days is a month. And so we wanted to lower it down as much as possible. There's, you know, like any other area of the law, you can't guarantee that there wouldn't be some sort of individual that would say, I'll bring it all current, and then knowing that at some point down the line, I will default again. But the problem with putting anything in there, we experimented, is that you essentially leave it uncertain forever. And so there's no way to close it off and to create certainty in it.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, Representative Grunberg.
And I just had thought, and obviously you're not going to cure it in this bill at this point in time, but since this is kind of a continuing revision process, I wonder if there's a way of having this in there, but a condition subsequent, that may not be the right word to use, so that if later on this person defaults in their child support, then they run the risk of the whole thing falling. That would be quite a hammer. I'm asking you this, Dave.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it's certainly something that we can think about some more, and I'd be happy to discuss it with a committee during the time when the legislature's not in session and you're discussing and considering legislation, and we can come up with something, especially if it turns out to be a problem for the Child Support Division.
Yeah, I don't want to create, through the chair, I don't want to create a problem if it isn't a problem here or hasn't been a problem. Just something to think about, and we don't need to pursue that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, with that, are there any further questions? And if not, Doug and Peter, do you have anything new to add to the dialogue?
This is Doug Blockmacher, and the only thing I have to say is that you know, we support this bill. We think it enhanced what we've been doing since 1997, and it has created a number of jobs in Alaska and has brought a lot of deposits to Alaska and a lot of money directly to the states of Alaska.
Representative Guerra?
Thank you. The parts of the bill that I suppose help attract customers to the state and to the business don't particularly trouble me, and they seem fine. Those I'm probably supportive of. There's one section that seems to aim to protect members of people who work in the industry from consumers, and that's Section 4. And that's the one that that does trouble me, that I mentioned before. And certainly I'm not saying there's anything untoward about that section, but it does trouble me. So just for people who don't know how this works, you have to file a claim at that point where you should have had reason within a certain number of months or years under a statute of limitations, from that point that you should have had reason to check into finding out whether or not somebody did something wrong to you, at the point where you are put on sufficient notice that you should start doing some research to determine whether somebody did something wrong to you. It seems to me people just really aren't going, that the reason for the existing law is that people will look closely at their final accounting, but just probably won't look closely at the interim accountings. So I guess if you could respond to that concern and then tell me what your feelings are about the bill if it doesn't pass out of here with Section 4 intact.
Through Madam Chairperson, Representative Guerra, We think this is an important provision, and it was recommended to us at the national conference that Dave Chaptel had mentioned. I think one of the differences is that, you know, we have now perpetual trusts that almost everyone we have is a perpetual trust that theory can last hundreds, if not a thousand years. And what it's just saying that if you have a trust that was started 100 years ago, all of a sudden, without this provision, a beneficiary could say, gee, I didn't like your action that you took 100 years ago. Looking in hindsight now, you should have invested in some other type of investment. And that just, there's no, you know, time limitation, and, you know, there won't be any. And I think the fact that, as I think was pointed out before, now when you get a final accounting, you are not notified that you have any time restriction. You're just given the final accounting. You may look at it, you may not, but you have a 6-month, you know, window to look at it. In this event, you have to be told that you have a 6-month window, and the statements that you receive have to be sufficient enough to have let you know that there was a problem. So it can't be that a statement is sent and doesn't disclose this information, and then you're off the hook. It has to have the information so a reasonable person could see what you did. So we think it's a very important provision, and we think it will attract a lot of business to additional business to Alaska. And we think a lot of trust will be sent to Alaska.
Let me just, there are a few more points. I'll let Representative Grunberg go next. But just on this point, I understand how it might, I don't understand how it would attract more people who want to trust to Alaska. Is somebody going to run up to Alaska and say, I want to hire a guy because he has a shorter statute of limitations? I mean, how does that attract consumers up here to want to do trust business up here? That part just doesn't seem to me to be, I don't understand that part.
Because there won't be any unnecessary trust litigation. In other words, because what happens now if a beneficiary of a trust that had started 100 years ago decided to take an action against the trustee at that point in time, the trustee has the ability to use the trust assets to protect itself. And if we'd have this long bunch of litigation, and if it came out that the trustee hadn't done anything wrong, the trust would have spent a significant sum of dollars on something that happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And a lot of people like the fact that there is a limitation. Hopefully that will keep beneficiaries. And I do believe that beneficiaries of trusts are a little more involved in that aspect than they may have with the relationship with their broker.
I've got a couple more questions, but I'm going to let the questions go around the room for right now.
Representative Grunberg?
Yes, on this point, and I really hadn't studied the bill, this is the first time I've seen this. We have been dealing with the issue of informed consent in at least two other areas within the last month in this committee. The area of informed consent for abortion, the area of informed consent for medical malpractice. And we've talked quite a bit about those informed consents. Here you're dealing with somebody who may be under a disability and may be represented by somebody else who may really be a lay person and in not much better position to make a determination of whether there's a potential claim for breach of trust and that sort of thing, which can be extremely technical and a very short limitation period of 6 months. That does concern me, particularly when you talk in the bill about, quote, adequately discloses. Is it adequate from the point of view of the beneficiary who may be under a disability, or from the point of view of the representative, or from the point of view of a trust officer or a reasonable person or what? And when you're talking about informing the beneficiary, I assume that when you talk about informing somebody, the passing on of knowledge would seem to assume, in my interpretation anyway, that the transmittal of that knowledge is adequate from the recipient's point of view, particularly because with such a short statute of limitation, this provision seems to me not drafted from the consumer's point of view. And I am concerned about this provision Mr. Shaftel, you want to make any comment? Or anybody there? I mean, you know, I'm not limiting it to anybody.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I guess the one thought I have on the whole area of accountings, and we've used them here in our office, we've used interim accountings without the statute because we feel it's to the beneficiary's advantage as well as to the for the trustee's protection to at least annually give an accounting and set up a procedure, and we've done this just through the court system where we'll ask for a hearing, and we will ask that if a beneficiary has any objection that they come in within a period of time and make their objection at that hearing. And we're doing this with the hope that will both draw their attention to what's been done over the past year. Because it seems to me it's much to the beneficiary's advantage to be focusing on his or her trust every year than to have a long period of time. Now, some trusts that we're talking about that would be covered by this statute, and the one I was just referring to, went on for about 10 years, and then it was wrapped up. It was, in effect, trust administration after the surviving spouse died. The trusts that Doug Lockmacher is referring to are trusts that don't have final accountings. They just continue on and on and on. And it does make a lot of sense for both the trustee, but also equally for the beneficiary, to focus on these trusts every year and have an interim accounting, which is what we're talking about here, that they have to focus on, but if something's wrong, it will have occurred in the last year, and they'll have the evidence and the people around who can verify that something went wrong. It seems to me it's to the beneficiary's disadvantage to be lulled into letting that trust just sit there, and at some point perhaps they'll look at it, have years go by where there's been a breach of trust or something else that they where they were harmed, and then have to go back and try and figure out what happened and try and find the people and gather the evidence. So there's some real advantage in interim accountings and having a procedure that focuses both the beneficiary for the beneficiary's protection and the trustee. For the trustee's protection and gets that segment of time resolved one way or another.
Madam Chair, just on that point, the language that you have in here only bars claims, quote, for breach of trust, unquote. Here, there is a new duty, and the duty is to make a report that adequately discloses the existence of a potential claim for a breach of trust, and that informs the beneficiary of the time allowed for commencing the proceeding. It seems to me that a sharp plaintiff's lawyer will simply restyle the complaint, and it will go against the person, the lawyer who makes the report, and it will say, you did not adequately disclose the existence of a potential claim for breach of trust. And so the careful trust lawyer will, in their report, include every possible potential claim for breach of trust, no matter how remote, simply to cover themselves against any malpractice claim. And this game will go on. It's just going to be slightly played out in a different field. What do you think?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you know, adequate disclosure is a concept that we're very familiar with in the trust and estates area. It's in the Internal Revenue Code, and it is something, the language that was dropped in is full disclosure, I think was felt to be ambiguous and require some type of perfection that couldn't be reached. So it's not a standard that we're unfamiliar with. Your points, I mean, clever attorneys on both sides can always make arguments, and ultimately those will have to be resolved by the court system if they get that far. But again, what this provision, as I understand it, is designed to do is to provide statutory support for interim accountings. And I'd be interested, if I could, Madam Chair, and just ask Representative Guerra, because I know he comes from a consumer protection background, if what he thinks of the other side of this provision, which is protection for the beneficiary by focusing the beneficiary on a yearly basis or an interim basis rather than after long periods of time on what's been happening to that beneficiary's trust. But I think that's a real significant advantage to the beneficiary.
Representative Hero?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I just think that you're going to get a mixed bag of clients. You're those who pay really close attention to their interim statements and those who don't. And I wouldn't begrudge either group of people. I'm thinking of a compromise that seems to meet the concerns that you mentioned, but meets my concerns too. The compelling argument that you make is you don't want somebody 100 years later to file a negligence claim against you. That makes sense.
Right.
On the other hand, I'm not so comfortable giving them only 6 months. That's one thing. The other thing is, again, I understand the you don't want somebody to file a sort of malpractice, negligence, malfeasance claim against you a long, long, long time later. But if it's fraud or theft or deceit, and there are commonly exceptions for that kind of conduct in the law, I guess I'm not so thrilled about shortening the statute of limitations for those things. So what I'm thinking of is changing the six-month period from the interim accounting to three years. You don't have to wait your whole life to hear about a claim in that circumstance, just 3 years. We've historically had statute of limitations up to 6 years and 10 years for property claims and things like that. That would be one thing. And the other would be to say that the new amendment that you proposed that applies to a date from the interim accounting applies for breach of trust, except for when that breach is fraud, theft, or deceit. And I can imagine cases of fraud, theft, or deceit. You know, in a down stock market, you expect that your portfolio is going to shrink, and you don't notice that it shrunk by an extra $100,000, and it shrunk by the extra $100,000 because somebody took your money. And, you know, as somebody who expected to lose money during that down market, you just didn't go and question whether or not somebody stole money from you. But I suppose somebody could come back and say later on, you should have noticed. You should have been more mistrustful. And so what I'm thinking of is just that. To give you what you're asking for, except for in those cases of egregious conduct, and to do it for 3 years rather than 6 months. How would that sit with you?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, personally, I don't have a problem with either of those changes, but I would like to defer to Doug Blockmacher and Peter Brodigan, who are involved in this provision.
Doug and Peter, what do you think, either of you?
This is Peter Brodigan in Anchorage, and my only thought is that 3 years seems very long, especially for an interim accounting issue, because that can affect future accountings and the way we are investing or the way the trustees are going to be investing the money. I'll defer to Doug on that issue, but the other point is the current statute provides for 6 months after the final accounting. Is the proposal that would also be changed to 3 years? And if so, I would encourage the group not to go for a 3 year on the final accounting.
Well, my understanding is that you've changed the date from the final accounting to from the interim accounting, right?
May I say something?
Representative Grunberg.
Okay. I was looking at this. I was thinking what Representative Guerra was talking about was changing the 6 months on line 6, but leaving the 3 years on line 12. On the other hand, Representative Guerra, I think the point's well taken, that the final accounting may, who knows when that would be, the final statute of limitations is 3 years after the final accounting. But you want to have it much shorter than that for the interim accounting. Maybe 3 years is too long on that. Why not make it like 2 years or something like that.
Again, this is Peter Brodigam in Anchorage. If it were 3 years for the final accounting, we would never be able to distribute the money from the trust for 3 years until after that statute of limitations had run. So if a client of mine would go to court and get a final accounting approved by the court, what we would advise our trustees is to hold on to the money for another 3 years, which would require tax returns and things of that nature. Again, I would prefer a 6 month on the final accounting.
Through the chair, do you have the bill in front of you, Mr. Brodigam?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, take a look at page 5, line 12. Isn't it now under the proposed language? In any event, all claims against the trustee are barred unless the proceeding is commenced within 3 years after the beneficiary's receipt of the final account or statement. With that language, aren't you going to give the advice you've just told me and say hold on to it for 3 years after the final accounting? Don't you want to, it seems to me that the language of the bill doesn't meet your needs. Am I wrong?
The answer is, I guess it would depend on the issues that are being presented and the concerns that it would depend on who the trustees is and who the issues and what the issues are. I guess we take that issue by issue as to whether we would withhold distribution of funds for 3 years. Doug, do you want to add to that?
Well, that's an important consideration, and I guess it would depend on the facts and circumstances. But I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what that says.
It's through the chair. It seems that the bill, if carefully read as it is here, may cause you a problem, and you guys may want to take a look at that before this thing gets signed into law, because that it may hold up all your clients for 3 years, and I don't think that's a good idea.
All right, I've got an idea. We're going to set this bill aside and bring it back up first thing Friday morning, and that will give you guys time to work out what you want to do with respect to the statute of limitations on both the interim accounting and the final accounting, and with that, we're going to take up now. Is it on this topic or a different topic?
It was on the court thing that I was talking about.
Okay, and on the court thing, I think there was no problem with that, so we'll just bring that up. I think he thought that was okay. Okay, next we're going to bring up Representative Anderson has to go chair Labor and Commerce, so we're going to bring his bill up so he can at least introduce it. And it is House Bill 427, Protection of Persons and Property.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And also, my staff is here. Jim, should we have the CS adopted now? Okay. Then I'm going to ask, while he passes those out right now, if I make a motion, and I'm going to have to wait till he gets to me because I don't know what the letter is. Version I.
Yeah. Version
I. If we could, I'll make a motion that we adopt version I of this bill, 23-LS1627/I, CS for House Bill 427, for discussion purposes.
Is there an objection to adopting version I for purposes of discussion? Hearing none, we have version I.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 427 just left the HES committee, and there were some amendments made and some changes recommended, and that's what's come to fruition in what's before you, this version I. The bill will go a long way towards preventing exploitation and mistreatment of vulnerable and incapacitated adults receiving the services of a private guardian or conservator, and that's the reason I sponsored the bill. It was drafted with input and basically guidance from the Alaska State Association of Guardianship and Advocacy, ASAGA, ASAGA, and then the Office of Public Advocacy, Josh Fink. He was actually the one who I worked with and talked with over the summer, and we decided to put in the bill last month. Also, the Adult Protective Services and the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office and the Disability Law Center, all of these groups, Senior Advocacy Coalition, and even the judiciary, I believe, support the bill and its general concept. And just real briefly, in Alaska, there are professional guardians, and they're both public and private, and family guardians, and they provide services to approximately 2,500 disabled, vulnerable adults. And under current law,
private guardians and conservators who are individuals with the responsibility to make housing, legal, and medical decision for the disabled, infirmed, and mentally ill. They are completely unregulated by the state. Many other states regulate private guardians, and I think appropriately so. And these vulnerable and incapacitated adults are easy prey, as you can well imagine as you read the paper, for those wishing to exploit their resources. So this legislation essentially grants the state regulatory authority over private guardians and conservators and establishes minimum qualifications and standards for them. The state oversight and standards for such a sensitive and critical job would ensure that these folks receive the best care and the care that they deserve. I could go on, but because we have such a tight schedule, I would just say that HB 427 allows the Division of Occupational Licensing, to revoke a private guardian's license if he or she has been found to have abandoned, exploited, abused, or neglected his or her ward, or has become unfit due to professional incompetence. And I think that's important. I mean, that punitive value to it, it keeps folks on guard. And in short, through this regulatory oversight and the establishment of professional and academic standards, the legislation will, in the end, help ensure disabled adults are not exploited by those entrusted to manage their affairs. And so I just think it's a really good piece of legislation. I give pretty much all the credit to Mr. Fink, who helped me craft it and is the brains behind it. I'm just a facilitator, as often is the case. But I definitely support it, and I know that there's a few people online, so I would defer the technical questions to them looking at the size of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Are there questions for Representative Anderson at this time? We have...
I have one question.
We have six folks from the Office of Public Advocacy on the line as well. Representative Gruenberg.
Representative Anderson, was this bill modeled on any other state's law?
I believe it was, and I would defer to, Representative, to Mr. Fink to answer that.
Maybe he can.
Yeah, he's crafted it from some other.
Okay, without further ado, Josh, are you there?
Madam Chairwoman, yes, I am. And just for the record, this is Josh Fink with the Office of Public Advocacy. The people here in my office aren't all at OPA. The LIO's conference room is under construction, so we moved the teleconference for Anchorage to our office.
Oh, perfect, because beside each of the name, it lists Office of Public Advocacy. Thank you, Josh.
And Josh, this is Rep. Anderson. I'm going to be departing in about 5 minutes, so Jim will be here if you have questions.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Anderson. And I don't have much to add, Madam Chair, except to thank Representative Anderson. This is important legislation. You know, in this state, we regulate barbers, hairdressers, acupuncturists, as it indicates in the sponsor statement, concert promoters, but we don't regulate guardians and conservators who, you know, take care of incapacitated, vulnerable adults who are in positions where they very easily could be exploited. And we've had some situations of concern over the past couple of years. This legislation, which was modeled off of pieces of Arizona's law, Washington State, was put together with a number of groups. Representative Anderson indicated who those groups were. And to correct the record, I do want to say I'm indebted to those people I worked with. I really took their product and brought it to Representative Anderson, and so he overcredits me. But I am grateful that he introduced that, and I'm here to answer any questions. We have a private guardian, I believe, online. We have someone from the Long-Term Ombudsman's Office, Executive Director of ASAGA, and my supervisor of the Public Guardian Section, James Parker here, he can answer technical questions. And with that, I know you've got a busy calendar, so I'll answer any questions.
Yes. Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, Mr. Fink, just for the record, was this bill modeled on the law of another state, or a model act, or a uniform act, or what? If it was, I'd like it in the record, because that will help if any court ever looks at this.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, and I'm getting this from Betty Wells with ASAGA, who's sitting next to me. Arizona and Washington, California and Texas have laws that require registration, and those laws were looked at when we drafted this. This legislation doesn't exactly perfectly mimic that, but those four states, we looked at their laws in designing this.
And I guess I have another question.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
It talks here about appointment of a guardian ad litem on page 11, And I'm wondering technically, and maybe this is something for Vanessa Tondini really to look at, does this technically have any modification of Civil Rule 17C, which governs GALs now in the civil rules? If it does, then we got to put it in the title and have the two-thirds vote. Do any of you folks know the answer to that one?
It's already amended E, 17E.
No, this is 17C.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's a different rule.
Do you know, Josh, is this indirectly or directly amending 17C? I guess it would be indirectly.
It'd be an indirect.
Madam Chairwoman, I don't believe so, but I'm going to walk down the hall and grab my court rules and look, and I can get back with you here in a few moments on that if you have other questions or want to take another chance to look that up.
Yeah, because you're already amending court rules anyway, so you already need that vote. Probably better to be careful than not. We just had obviously, you know, the public interest litigant case was thrown out on the ruling that it was an indirect court rule change, and we didn't follow the proper procedure, so better to be careful than not.
Madam Chair,
Representative Grunberg?
I think it may well amend 17C. If you folks have your 17C handy, I don't have it here. My recollection is 17C gives the court discretion to appoint a GAL, and it looks to me on line page 11, line 21, it says, upon the request of a ward or a protected person or a respondent or the attorney, the court shall appoint a GAL. That would seem to modify 17C as reducing the court's discretion. So if you look at it at least from that point of view.
Representative Gruenberg, this is Jim Parker. I'm not sure that it does, because Civil Rule 17C allows the court to appoint a guardian ad litem to sue or defend on behalf of an infant or incompetent person. This proposed change is not creating a right for a guardian ad litem, but modifying an existing statute about the process of appointing a guardian ad litem and the function primarily of a guardian ad litem. Also, Rule 17C says that the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem for an infant or incompetent person not otherwise represented in an action. So in this particular case, there is a more specific statute under Title 13 allowing for appointment of a guardian ad litem. So this is the first time we've thought about this, to be honest, but I don't think that it does modify Rule 17C.
That's a probate rule. Madam Chair, if you read, it was a probate rule, 17E. But if you continue reading the part of the rule you just quoted, it said, shall make the order or the appointment as it deems proper. It seems to make it, now I don't know, I'd have to look at this, but my recommendation is, if in doubt, let's make sure we don't get this thing struck down. Yeah, you might take that. Yeah, we're going to request a legal on that one, a legal opinion.
Okay, anything further, Josh, you want to add?
No, Madam Chairwoman, I do. I have Betty Wells here from Asaga.
Okay.
I have a number of other individuals who may want to make very brief comments. I understand the committee is beginning to calendar.
Yeah. What I want to do is try to get your bill out, so that's the eye toward that. Okay, Betty Wells?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I work as a court visitor in Anchorage and the surrounding areas, and I've been involved in adult guardianship for the last 15 years. I'm a member of ASAGA and the chair of the task force that called the folks together to put this bill together. Through that affiliation and my affiliation with the National Guardianship Association, I'm aware that Alaska is not alone in reviewing and changing the statute to protect vulnerable adults. Although most of the changes proposed in this bill clarify current statutory language and practice, there is new legislation proposed to regulate private agencies, and I believe that to be a vital part of the bill. With some abuse that we uncovered in a lengthy court trial on the viability of a private agency in 2001 and 2002, we discovered that we really couldn't continue to operate without some form of registration or licensure of private professional guardians. Our current statutes leave us vulnerable to a system where there is opportunity for corruption, as discovered in our own court case. And as stated before, there are no regulations providing any oversight to private guardianship agencies. The court monitors individual guardianships, and our statutes have provisions for mandatory reporting. Unfortunately, it's not adequate for the oversight that we need. Passing this legislation will assist the courts by licensing professional guardians. It will take the question of an agency's qualifications or viabilities out of the court system and allow them to concentrate on the merits of each case. I've learned that Alaska is a leader with respect to respondents' rights in adult guardianship cases. They have the right to an attorney, to a hearing, to a jury trial on the issue of incapacity. We have a great public guardianship program for those indigent adults who qualify. There is room, however, for private agencies in Alaska, and ASAGA supports the appointment of private agencies when appropriate by mandating regulations and the establishment of professional standards. Alaska will continue to be a leader with respect to these issues. Passing this bill will go a long way in putting the trust back into the system. ASAGA anticipates only a small number of licenses will be issued and anticipates no fiscal note, as the fees generated for obtaining the license will cover the cost. Licensure will ensure continuing education in the areas of guardianship, and ASAGA already sponsors at least one conference each year where people can get their continuing ed. The bill also outlines minimum educational requirements for families and friends that wish to become appointed. I'd like to thank Representative Anderson for sponsoring House Bill 427 and the Judiciary Committee for hearing this bill and the opportunity to voice my support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wells. We appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for Betty Wells? Representative Gruenberg.
This is for somebody. And I don't know if it's one of the attorneys there. This looks like I'm back on the appointment of the guardian ad litem. I think there may be other conflicts with 17C, but which we can look at later. But I had a case where I thought it was let me tell you the facts of the case. It was a situation. It was a child in need of aid case. It was a mother who was mentally ill. The mother had murdered the father, and she saw demons coming out of the television set. She locked the child in the closet. There had been a guardian ad litem appointed for the mother, an attorney, a guardian ad litem, and the guardian ad litem represented the mother's best interest. This was not terminating her rights, but simply adjudicating the child, a child in need of aid. It was called a dependent in those days. And they were going to keep the kid with the mom, but have a social worker. The mom did not want the appointment to be made to have the child in need of aid. And her prior attorney, they made him her guardian ad litem and appointed me to represent her. I tried to get the GAL removed because obviously he had seen how really crazy she was, and I felt he had come into confidential information. The judge refused to remove him as the guardian ad litem. So her prior attorney, in receipt of confidential information, using it against his ward, was kept in the case. Looking here for appointments, I want to be sure that the people in that situation would be removed at night. If there's a conflict of interest.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? This is Jim Parker in Anchorage.
Yes, I can.
I can tell you what the thinking was behind the amendment. The statute currently provides for the appointment of a guardian ad litem, but that is The first thing that occurs is the appointment of an attorney to represent the respondent, and the attorney is to act under the traditional attorney-client model, where the attorney advocates for the expressed wishes of his client. There has been nationally criticism of the effectiveness of representation of respondents in guardianship cases. I don't think we have a tremendous problem here, but there has been, it has been noted that at times there's been a tendency for attorneys, when they are representing incapacitated persons, to advocate not for what the client says, but for what they believe is in the client's best interest. The feeling was that this statute, as it currently is written, is not clear enough that the attorney should act as an attorney unless it is impossible for the attorney to ascertain or for the client to communicate what their wishes or preferences or desires are concerning the issues at stake in the guardianship case. So the way we would hope this would work is that a person would enter an appearance as an attorney, or more frequently they would be appointed, because most attorneys for respondents in guardianship cases are appointed. When they visited with their client, they would certainly attempt to have a conversation about the issues at hand and what the client's position would be. But there are, I can tell you, there are a certain number of cases where a person is going to be nonverbal, or perhaps they're in a coma, and at that point you simply cannot act as an attorney in the traditional sense, where you're advocating for your client's wishes. So